Jesus didn't just teach truth. He asked and listened. What if we did the same? Welcome to Hear the Heart, where we want to connect eternal truth with everyday life. And we don't just want to talk at you, but help equip you to listen to God and others, to hear the heart. Now, let's join our hosts.
You know that that very specific, almost physical feeling you get when you're just walking down the street?
Oh, yeah, like when you're in a rush.
Right. You're in a rush, maybe trying to like grab a coffee or make a meeting, and you see someone sitting on the sidewalk asking for help.
Mm-hmm.
And instantly, I mean, your body reacts before your brain even fully processes the situation. You do that little pivot.
You avoidant pivot, yeah.
Exactly. You look down at your phone, and suddenly you're just fascinated by some app you haven't opened in like 3 months.
Yeah.
Or you stare intently at the architecture across the street.
Right. Anything to look away.
Yeah. And you can actually feel this heavy iron door just swinging shut inside your chest. Like, click, lock, safe.
Which, I mean, it's completely natural. That iron door is essentially a survival mechanism.
You think so?
Oh, definitely. We shut it because empathy is, well, it's incredibly expensive.
Yeah. That makes
sense. And in a world that is just constantly bombarding us with need, keeping your heart open, it costs time, it costs emotional energy and, you know, resources.
It really does.
So your brain just runs this quick subconscious calculation and decides, I simply don't have the emotional budget to care right now.
But, you know, what happens when that heavy iron door gets stuck shut?
Yeah.
Like, permanently.
That is the big question.
And that's exactly what we're getting into in today's deep dive.
Yeah.
The whole mission here is figuring out how to live with genuine compassion. Like, how do we actually hear, understand, welcome, and encourage the people around us?
Which is not easy.
No, not at all. So to figure out how to pry that iron door back open, we're unpacking this fascinating stack of notes.
Yeah, and I think establishing the context right up front is super important here. The source material is deeply rooted in the Christian faith.
Definitely.
And, you know, as believers ourselves, that framework really shapes how we view compassion. Our ultimate goal is to live in light of the love of God and reflect that care toward others.
Right. But I want to be really clear to you, the listener, right now, whether you're listening to this as a devout believer or as someone who has very real, completely valid hesitations about following Jesus.
Or just religion in general.
Exactly. We want you to know this conversation is absolutely for you. We're not here to be pushy at all.
No, not at all.
Because the underlying question is universal, right? How do we keep our hearts open in a world that relentlessly trains us to close them?
Yeah, it's a human question.
Okay, let's unpack this. Starting with a really brilliant framework Handy uses about family traits.
Oh, I love this part. The family trait analogy really grounds the whole discussion, because if you look at certain families, they share this like almost instinctual characteristic.
A specific skill set or something.
Right. The notes use the example of a family that has run a Christmas tree farm for 40 years.
Okay.
A kid growing up in that environment, they just inherently know the business. They understand the soil, the watering patterns, like exactly when and where to cut a tree.
It's just in their blood.
Exactly. It isn't just a job for them. Or he mentions, think of a circus family who instinctively understands tight ropes or working with the animals. Or a business family where the kids are just naturally talking about the stock market at dinner.
Yeah, I actually immediately thought of a family of mechanics.
Oh, totally.
Right. Like, we all know a family like this in our hometown. The parents own an auto shop, and somehow even their 15-year-old teenager just intuitively knows how to rebuild an engine block.
Like, they didn't even have to learn it.
Yeah. They could be standing in the driveway, listen to a car drive by, and correctly diagnose a bad alternator just from the whine of the belt.
That's wild, but so true.
It's not something they had to sit down and study flashcards for.
Yeah.
You know, it's just the environment they breathe. So if we take that very grounded earthly reality, we have to ask how that translates to spirituality.
What's fascinating here is the source material applies this exact same logic to God.
Okay.
The argument is that God has a specific defining family trait. And if you are part of God's family, you are naturally going to exhibit that trait.
And that trait is love.
Yes, exactly. And in this framework, love isn't just this fleeting emotion you feel when you watch a heartwarming commercial on TV.
Right. It's not just a fuzzy feeling.
No, it's an identifying DNA marker. It's proof of origin.
Wow. It's like the ultimate paternity test. You look at the actions of the person to see who their father is.
That's a great way to put it. And the text cites John 13:3-5, where Jesus states that by your love for one another, all people will know that you are his disciple.
So the love is the undeniable proof.
Exactly. It's a family business. I mean, sure, you might be naturally drawn to love certain people because you have an affinity for them or, you know, shared hobbies.
The easy people.
Right, the easy ones. But others, the difficult ones, the strangers, the people who just completely drain you, you choose to love them simply because it's your family trait.
You find this unusual strength to love them because it's who you are now. So if love is the defining DNA marker of this spiritual family, the obvious question for me is, what is the alternative? Like, what does it look like when we abandon that family trait and just default to our natural human impulses?
Well, the text draws a really stark, actually very uncomfortable contrast between two historical figures, Cain and Jesus.
Okay. Cain from the Old Testament.
Right. Cain represents the absolute baseline of the natural human response when left completely alone, like devoid of God's spirit or any supportive community.
What does that baseline look like?
Well, when his brother Abel's righteousness made him look bad, Cain's immediate response was jealousy.
Yeah.
And that jealousy led directly to murder. The source uses this chillingly simple equation for the natural human condition. It says, I don't like you equals I kill you.
Wow. I don't like you equals I kill you. That scales up so quickly, too.
It really does.
Because it starts as, I don't like your music, so I'll insult you. Then it becomes, I don't like your politics, I'll ruin your reputation.
Yep.
And eventually, on a macro level, it becomes, I don't like your country, so I'll bomb you.
Exactly. That is the default mechanism of a closed heart. It's self-preservation at the absolute expense of the other person.
Okay. And Jesus is the opposite.
The lethal opposite. Instead of sacrificing others for his own benefit, which is basically the mechanism of hatred, Jesus offers voluntary sacrificial love at his own cost.
He absorbed the cost.
Right. He laid down his life. No one took it from him. He absorbed it rather than inflicting it.
Well, that actually brings us to a massive speed bump in the source material.
Oh, yeah. The murder comparison.
Yes. Handy brings up 1 John 3.15 and Matthew 5.22, which make this incredibly intense claim. He says, hating your brother is equated to being a murderer.
It's heavy.
Now, I have to push back on this on behalf of you, the listener, because honestly, that sounds like massive hyperbole.
It does sound extreme.
Right. I mean, I might strongly dislike the guy in the office next to me who steals my lunch from the fridge, or I might despise a political rival I see on the news. I might even harbor some deep resentment toward an ex. But I am certainly not a murderer. Equating the two feels like a massive stretch.
I get that. On the surface, it absolutely feels like an exaggeration. But the sources unpack the underlying psychology and really the spiritual mechanics of why they are equated.
Okay, how so?
There's a quote included in the notes from John R. Rice. He says, when boiled down to its essence, unforgiveness is hatred.
Okay, unforgiveness is hatred.
But the concept that really nails the mechanism is from Harry Emerson Fosdick. He said, hating people is like burning down your own house to get rid of a rat.
Wait, really? Burning down your own house to get rid of a rat?
Yeah.
That completely shifts the perspective.
Yeah.
Because we usually think of hatred as a weapon we point at someone else.
Exactly. But hatred is an internal arson. It destroys the container it's held in.
Wow.
When you harbor resentment, you think you're punishing the person who wronged you. But physiologically and spiritually, you are destroying yourself. Your body is pumping cortisol.
Your stress levels just spike.
Right. Your cognitive load is entirely consumed by this person who, let's be honest, probably isn't even thinking about you.
That is so true.
And Handy writes that there is no eternal life swirling around inside a heart that is full of hate. Eternal life from God doesn't look to kill. It doesn't act on selfish, destructive impulses.
So you're acting outside the family patterns.
Exactly. If your heart is full of hatred, you're holding a lit match inside your own chest.
Man, but, you know, nobody wants to look in the mirror and admit, hey, I harbor a lot of hatred and I'm currently burning down my own internal house.
No, nobody admits that.
So we develop this natural defense mechanism. We just loudly declare to the world and mostly to ourselves, I am a loving person.
Right. We try to speak the identity into existence without actually doing any of the heavy lifting.
And Handy has this hilarious reality check in the notes about this.
Oh, the fighter jet thing.
Yes. He points out the absurdity of claiming an identity without the corresponding action. He says, imagine if I just stood in the middle of a room and announced, I am a mouse, or I am a chair.
Right.
Or my personal favorite from his sermon, he just yells, I'm a fighter jet. Pew, pew, pew.
Yeah, making airplane noises and running around the room doesn't actually give you wings.
Exactly. Mm. Just saying I am a loving person doesn't make you one. And 1 John 3.18 explicitly says, let us not love in word or talk, but in deed and in truth.
And the standard for that action is Jesus. His example shows that true love requires three specific elements. It must be voluntary, it must be sacrificial, and it must be thorough.
Thorough.
Yeah. He didn't just give out of his surplus time or, you know, toss a few spare coins at a problem. He laid down his life. It cost him deeply.
And let's just speak directly to you listening right now. We completely understand the real world friction here.
Oh, totally.
In theory, we all want the title of loving person. But in reality, it is incredibly hard to love sacrificially because, well, we cherish our comfort.
We really do.
We fiercely guard our peace, our weekends, our rest, our bank accounts. The second love demands that we give up our precious free time or resources. Our internal alarms go off, and that heavy iron door starts swinging shut again.
Because we want the reputation of compassion without paying the invoice. And the invoice is steep.
It really is. Acknowledging how quickly that door shuts, Handy pivots to a highly practical toolkit in the second half of his notes. He calls them doorstops for a closing heart.
I love that visual.
Me too. Here's where it gets really interesting. He gives us five specific wedges to physically shove under that heavy iron door to keep it open when our instinct is to lock it. Let's dig into the mindset doorstops first.
Okay, so the first doorstop is understanding. The source points out a fundamental psychological reality here. It is incredibly easy to hate someone you don't care about.
Yeah.
And it's easy to care nothing about someone you simply don't understand. Ignorance breeds apathy.
So what's the actionable advice?
Aggressive empathy. You have to actively learn about the people you have a hard time loving.
And he actually suggests watching documentaries as a practical step for this, right?
He does.
Which, I mean, it sounds almost too simple. But the mechanics behind it are actually fascinating. When we hear abstract statistics about, say, global poverty or addiction, our brains just categorize it as an out-group problem.
We distance ourselves from it.
Exactly. But a documentary forces you to look at a human face. It triggers your mirror neurons. It bypasses the analytical, defensive part of your brain and forces you to connect with their specific, deeply human context.
You can't unsee their humanity once you truly understand their story.
Right. But, and here's my question. Understanding only goes so far. What happens when you understand a person's context and you realize they actually kind of deserve the mess they're in?
Yeah.
Like maybe they made terrible, destructive choices that hurt everyone around them. How do you love them then?
That brings us to doorstop number two, graciously.
Okay.
This is where we dive right into the core gospel context of the message. The remedy for a judgmental, closed heart is to remember your own position.
It's the ultimate reality check.
Exactly. For those of us who follow Jesus, this means looking directly at the cross. We have to remember that absolutely nothing we ever did earned the mercy and sacrificial love of God.
We didn't deserve it.
Right. We were the ones who made the terrible choices. It cost Jesus everything to save us. So when you truly grasp the mechanics of grace, that you received an immeasurable gift you did not deserve, it utterly destroys your right to judge your neighbor.
It completely levels the playing field.
It provides the fuel to graciously serve them, completely independent of whether you think they deserve it.
Which naturally leads to doorstop three, diligently.
Yes.
Because love is purposeful, intentional work. I really think modern culture has sold us this lie that love should just be a natural, effortless wave of emotion.
We just think it should happen.
Right. We think if we are generally good people, compassion will just bubble up organically. But Handy compares it to becoming an expert in a highly technical field.
This is such a good point. If you sit down with a master carpenter or concert pianist or even that seasoned auto mechanic we talked about earlier,
yeah,
they will all tell you the exact same thing. Expertise is not just raw natural talent. It is muscle memory forged through thousands of hours of unseen repetitive hard work.
You don't get calluses on your hands by just feeling like a carpenter.
No, you have to swing the hammer.
You really do.
Yeah.
And love takes that exact same practice. Waiting to love naturally in a flawed, exhausting world is a guaranteed way to become cold.
Oh, absolutely.
The world, your own flesh, the stress of your job, the pull of selfishness, they're all actively conspiring to close that iron door. You have to diligently, purposefully wedge it open every single day, even when you feel absolutely nothing.
So those three, understanding, graciously, and diligently, those are the internal mindset shifts.
Right.
But a mindset without physical application is just the fighter jet delusion all over again.
Pew, pew, pew.
Exactly. Mm-hmm. What does this look like on a random Tuesday afternoon when you are running late and you're just stressed out?
That brings us to the action doorstops. Doorstop 4 is by seeing. And to explain this, Handy uses a highly unexpected, slightly hilarious reference to the movie Titanic.
Near, far, wherever you are.
Yes. Celine Dion making an appearance in the deep dive. It's funny, but underneath the joke is a really profound piece of practical instruction.
Look near and look far.
Right. Look near.
Yeah.
Actually see the people who are geographically and relationally close to you, your neighbors, your coworkers, your family. And look far. Actively see the people globally who lack access to basic necessities.
But the real gut punch of that point is wherever you are.
Yeah.
He specifically points out the homeless person in a large city. If you ask someone living on the streets, they will tell you the number one way people avoid them is by actively choosing not to see them.
It's the pivot we talked about at the very beginning of the show, staring at the architecture.
Exactly. We look right through them because making eye contact demands an emotional transaction.
But Handy gives a highly specific, actionable takeaway for you listening right now. He says, keep a box of granola bars and bottles of water in your car.
It's so practical.
Don't just hope you'll feel generous if the moment arises. Prepare your environment to facilitate generosity. He advocates for actively budgeting our finances so we actually have money to give away.
And budgeting our time, too.
Yes, deliberately budgeting our time so we have a surplus to offer when people are in crisis.
But, you know, this raises an important question.
Okay, what is it?
If we are constantly seeking to understand, pouring out grace, diligently working at love, and actively seeing everyone's needs, how do we do all of this without completely burning out?
That's real. Compassion fatigue is a very real, very destructive neurological and emotional reality.
It is.
Because if you try to fix everyone's problems, you will empty your own tank in a week. Basic math says if you give everything away constantly, you just hit zero, you crash.
Which is exactly why doorstop 5 is perhaps the most crucial for long-term endurance.
And what is that one?
Within measure, Handy heavily emphasizes the absolute necessity of boundaries.
Boundaries. Okay.
You have to ask yourself hard, highly practical questions before taking on a burden. Like, how much time do I actually have right now? What emotional and physical responsibilities will loving this person require of me?
Right. Can I get a community of people to help? Mm-hmm. Or am I trying to be the sole savior here?
Exactly. Is there a different format for loving them that is less time-consuming but still deeply meaningful?
But wait, it almost sounds counterintuitive to the whole idea of sacrificial love we just talked about.
Yeah.
Doesn't setting a boundary mean you aren't being fully sacrificial?
That's a great pushback, but it's the difference between a sacrifice and a suicide mission.
Oh, wow.
The source issues a really stark warning. If you do not measure your capacity, you will inevitably become bitter.
Bitter, yeah.
Let's look at the mechanism of bitterness for a second. Bitterness doesn't usually sprout from a lack of caring. No, it often comes when we are deeply frustrated by a heavy burden we've willingly taken on, but we just can't see a way out. We feel trapped by our own unchecked compassion.
So if you don't measure your capacity and set healthy boundaries, your heart won't just close.
It will lock from the inside, fuse shut by resentment.
Man, bitterness is the rust that freezes the door, hinges permanently.
Exactly.
So to keep it functioning, we have to understand the unknown, dive into unmerited grace. Work diligently like a master craftsman, actively see the invisible people around us, and rigorously measure our capacity so we don't break under the weight.
It is a complete holistic toolkit for the human heart.
As we bring this deep dive to a close, the notes summarize this entire journey by stating that love isn't just a calling for the family of God. It is a calling card. It's the proof of life.
The undeniable DNA marker that proves who you belong to.
So what does this all mean? Let's take it right to your front door. I want to ask you, the listener, the exact same questions Daryl Handy asks in his message. Who can you love this week? And let's move past just, you know, throwing $20 at a charity.
Right.
What do you have? Maybe it's your time, a genuinely listening ear, a shoulder to cry on, or your prayers that you can share. Who is sitting alone around you right now, maybe in your office or your neighborhood, who desperately needs a phone call or a visit?
Or who needs to learn a skill that you have already mastered.
Exactly.
And as you picture those names and faces, I really want to leave you with a final thought to chew on.
Let's hear it.
It's based on a benediction from Proverbs 11.24, found at the very end of the source notes.
Okay.
The verse basically says that one person gives freely and grows richer, while another withholds what they should give, and they just suffer want.
That's quite a paradox.
It is. We spend an enormous amount of our daily energy trying to keep that heavy iron door locked tight. We convince ourselves that we are protecting our precious time, guarding our fragile emotional energy, and hoarding our resources by keeping our hearts closed to the messy, demanding reality of other people.
We really think we're building a safe room.
We do. But if hatred and apathy are like burning down your own house, and sacrificial love is the family trait that builds it, The question isn't whether you can afford the exhausting cost of leaving the door open to others.
Right.
The real question is whether your soul can survive locking itself inside. A safe room, kept sealed long enough, eventually just becomes a vault where you suffocate on your own recycled air.
Wow. Suffocating on your own recycled air. Maybe it's time to wedge that door open. Yeah. Even just a crack. Let some new air in. Let the family trait do its work.
Thanks for joining us for another podcast. No matter what perspective you're coming from, we hope that Hear the Heart stirs your heart in some very good ways. We want to show how the teachings of Jesus are instructive for those who believe and inviting for those who don't. I hope we accomplished our mission with this week's Hear the Heart podcast.